John Dennis here on Wednesday, the 8th of April. Today, film footage obtained by The Guardian reveals police throwing a man to the ground during last week's G20 protests, just moments before he collapsed and died.
He has his hands in his pockets. The riot police officer appears to initially strike at his legs with a baton and then push him from behind. And he's propelled quite forcefully through the air onto the pavement.
Also today, as Barack Obama prepares to withdraw American troops from Iraq, fresh sectarian tensions threaten to erupt into violence and chaos.
They're going as fast as they can in the process of national reconciliation, but it's a very Byzantine process. Iraqi politics, it's very slow, there's many groups, it's very complicated.
And a record level of litter on Britain's beaches.
A lot of the problem is now so many items are made of plastic, and as useful as plastic is, in the marine environment it's incredibly long-lasting, estimates of hundreds of thousands of years, and it doesn't really ever sort of biodegrade.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
First, Bill Overton's here with the news.
The Liberal Democrats are demanding a criminal inquiry after video footage obtained by The Guardian showed police at the G20 summit pushing a man who later died. Ian Tomlinson can be seen being shoved from behind and thrown to the ground by a baton-wielding officer. The 47-year-old newspaper vendor, who was on his way home from work, suffered a heart attack and died moments after the assault. The Guardian will hand a dossier of the evidence it's obtained to the police watchdog. The rescue effort following the earthquake in central Italy continues today. A powerful aftershock has caused two apartment blocks in L'Aquila to collapse, but hope remains that more survivors will be found after a woman was pulled alive from the rubble after 42 hours. The Parliament Square protest against the war in Sri Lanka is carrying on for a third day. Tamil demonstrators want the UK to take action against the Sri Lankan government, who they say are trying to wipe out rebel Tamil Tigers in the north of the country. Tens of thousands of protesters have gathered in the Thai capital Bangkok, calling for the Prime Minister to resign. Supporters of the former PM, Thaksin Shinawatra, claim that the current leader took power illegally after a military coup in 2006. Shinawatra has been living abroad in self-imposed exile since the coup and faces jail if he returns to Thailand. Meanwhile, riot police in the former Soviet state of Moldova have regained control of the parliament building in the capital, Chisinau. Earlier, protesters had stormed the building following the re-election of the Communist Party. Thousands of demonstrators smashed furniture, threw computers through windows and lit fires. The Moldovan president says the attacks by a handful of fascists drunk on anger amount to a coup. Police are bracing themselves for more violence. Sport and Arsenal drew 1-1 in the first leg of their Champions League quarter-final against Villarreal. The Spaniards dominated the first half, but Emmanuel Adebayo equalised the score with a stunning overhead kick. Manchester United, on the other hand, face a battle to progress in the league after drawing 2-2 with Porto. Now, taking a look at the papers, The Guardian leads with a still taken from that video footage captured at the G20 protests. It shows Ian Tomlinson stumbling to the ground after encountering police in riot gear. "Now it's time for justice," says family, is the accompanying headline. The paper says Mr. Tomlinson's family have remained publicly silent in the week since his death, not wanting to prejudice the investigation into it. Now, though, they want answers. The Independent claims an exclusive with Brown's Electric Dream for Britain. The Prime Minister says in an interview that he wants to make Britain a world leader in the production and export of electric cars, and that 400,000 jobs could be created in green industries over the next 5 years. He's also set to approve an experiment to develop a clean coal industry through carbon capture technology. The Daily Telegraph reports that Liam Neeson's returning to public life after the death of his wife Natasha Richardson. The Irish film star is pictured at the 70th birthday of TV broadcaster Sir David Frost, along with other high-profile figures like Alistair Campbell, Rory Bremner and Billy Connolly. On its front page, the Mail goes with Sinn Féin MP's £500,000 expenses racket. Several of the papers picking up on this story today. The five Sinn Féin MPs who refuse to take their seats in the House of Commons are claiming more than £100,000 a year in parliamentary second-term expenses. The Republican movement has confirmed that the money is used to rent two houses in London, used by Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness and three others. The FT, meanwhile, focuses on the continuing woes of the Home Secretary Jackie Smith, claiming that she's become the lightning rod for public opinion in the growing row over expenses. Finally, The Express and Mail both report on a growing trend in sun-starved Britain. Alarming rise in skin cancer, says The Express, while The Mail screams tanorexia. They cite a new study linking a rise in the use of sunbeds with melanoma. More news and comment throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
Last Wednesday evening, as police attempted to control anti-capitalist protesters ahead of last week's G20 summit in London, a 47-year-old man named Ian Tomlinson collapsed and died near the Bank of England. Today, the Independent Police Complaints Commission is studying video footage obtained by The Guardian that shows Mr. Tomlinson moments before he died. City of London police said he died of natural causes. They said he suffered a sudden heart attack while on his way home from work. But the footage sheds new light on Mr. Tomlinson's death. Paul Lewis has the details.
Well, it shows us something really very significant. It shows us Ian Tomlinson, who is the man who died last Wednesday at the G20 protest. He wasn't a protester, he was walking through the area, being attacked by a riot police officer from behind. He has his hands in his pockets. The riot police officer appears to initially strike at his legs with a baton and then push him from behind, and he's propelled quite forcefully through the air onto the pavement. He's then seen remonstrating with police for 10, 15 seconds. They do nothing to help him, and it's other protesters and bystanders in the area who help him to his feet. Approximately 3 minutes after that footage was shot, Ian Tomlinson collapsed and died of a heart attack.
This seems to tally with some statements that have been given to the Independent Police Complaints Commission, alleging that the police assaulted Mr. Tomlinson shortly before he died.
Yeah, actually those statements were given to us, to The Guardian. We've obtained those and we're giving them to the Independent Police Complaints Commission. So that's evidence that we've gathered. Not all of them saw exactly what happened to Ian Tomlinson. Some of the people who attended to him were on the phone to the ambulance. A medical student put him in the recovery position. There were people who saw him in the vicinity, or there were people who were in the vicinity and saw police dogs biting people, police officers' batons hitting people in the area at the same location and at the same time that Ian Tomlinson was attacked in our video footage.
There have been calls for a public inquiry and for a full inquest into this case. I guess this video makes that more likely.
Well, could do. I mean, it's kind of not for me to say because I see my position really as the reporter who's trying to identify the facts and get them out there. What the family's position is, what the Metropolitan Police's position is, and what the Home Secretary's position is, we're yet to find out. But obviously the implications of something like this are really, really very serious.
Paul Lewis. And you can see the film and follow the reaction to The Guardian story today at guardian.co.uk/G20. Also on The Guardian's website today, Tony Chambers of Wallpaper on what we have learnt about MPs' interiors from their expenses. Guardian.co.uk/politics. John Henley looks at some surprise successes of the credit crunch. Guardian.co.uk/business. And Wale Soyinka, whose play Death and the King's Horseman is being revived at the National Theatre, is interviewed at guardian.co.uk/arts. Barack Obama flew into Baghdad yesterday. It was his first trip to Iraq since becoming president. But his morale-boosting visit comes amid fresh tensions between Sunni Arab groups and the Shia-led coalition government of the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. There have been a series of suicide bombings as US troops prepare to leave Iraq's towns and cities this summer. The relative calm of the last 18 months depended on Sunni militias cooperating with the Shia-dominated government. I asked our foreign affairs commentator, Simon Tisdall, if the Iraqi government can count on their continued support.
It's certainly not guaranteed, John. There's been signs in recent months of a fraying of the relationship between the Sunni community and the Shia-led government. Last week in East Baghdad, there were quite fierce fighting between one of the Sunni militias, the Sons of Iraq, which the Americans co-opted as part of the surge, and government forces. There's been arrests by the government of some of the Sunni group leaders, and there are a lot of complaints from the Sunni politicians that an opportunity for national reconciliation, for the inclusion of the Sunni community, which of course is a minority community in Iraq, in the government, in government jobs, and payment of the militias by the government, which the Americans will soon be stopping and doing themselves, and also inclusion of Sunni troops, fighters in the national security forces. All of this is not happening, or not happening fast enough.
And what's Nouri al-Maliki saying about these suggestions that it's not happening fast enough?
Well, al-Maliki fought the provincial elections in January on a sort of nationalist, secular agenda, focusing on economic and social issues rather than issues of religious or ethnic identity. He, I I think, would like to see those issues pushed to one side and Iraqis identify themselves as Iraqis rather than members of individual communities. He always tells the Americans, and I'm sure Barack Obama's asking him about it today, that they're going as fast as they can in the process of national reconciliation and bringing in some of the groups, the Baathists, for instance, who were outlawed after the 2003 invasion. But it's a very Byzantine process, Iraqi politics. It's very slow. There's many groups. It's very complicated.
And if the national elections due to be held in December aren't peaceful, how will that affect Barack Obama's plans to withdraw American troops from Iraq?
Well, there's a series of hurdles coming up which are going to test the whole Obama timetable for Iraq. As you know, he's set a 16-month limit on the American troop presence. He wants all but a maximum of 50,000 troops out by summer of next year, and all of them are due to leave under the Status of Forces Agreement signed with the Iraqi government by the end of 2011. Obama's plan also calls for all American combat troops to withdraw from Iraqi cities and towns this summer. So one of the first big tests is going to be whether the Iraqi police forces and army, who have of course been trained by American and British troops, are up to filling the gap that's going to be created by this withdrawal from urban areas. And the second test will be the campaign in the autumn for the December elections and whether Iraqis are going to find themselves in a stable and secure environment in which they can cast a vote.
And if America is unable to withdraw its troops because Iraq returns to violence, that will seriously hamper Obama's other foreign policy objectives.
Potentially it can. It has an obviously serious knock-on effect. There's about 145,000 troops there now. By this time next year, Obama would hope to have the majority of them out. There is talk of redeploying considerable numbers to Afghanistan. And if Iraq's security deteriorates, if sectarianism comes back, if there's more signs of revived al-Qaeda, who may have been responsible for the car bombings there in Baghdad on Monday, then that will slow that redeployment, that repositioning of American forces. It also has potentially serious consequences for Obama's attempt to outreach to Iran next door. Iran, of course, historically accused of meddling in Iraq and stirring up sectarian tensions. If things get difficult or violent there again, it may be that Iran will get sucked in. That will complicate the American attempts at detente with Iran and also with Syria on the other side of the country.
Simon Tisdall. Still to come on Guardian Daily, the latest from L'Aquila, the historic mountain city devastated by Italy's worst earthquake in almost 30 years.
The death toll, despite expectations to the contrary, has risen above 200, and we now know that more than 1,000 people were injured, 100 of them seriously.
But first, the Sri Lankan government has rejected international calls for a ceasefire as its army attempts to wipe out every last trace of the Tamil Tigers. The rebel group is now reduced to a rump, fighting for an independent homeland from just a small part of northern Sri Lanka. But the United Nations says that up to 150,000 people are trapped in the war zone. Anne-Marie Loof is head of mission from the aid charity Médecins Sans Frontières. The Guardian's Jonathan Steele asked her what MSF has been able to do for those people trapped on the narrow strip of land.
For the people that are stuck on that narrow strip of beach under terrible circumstances, unfortunately MSF is not able to do anything as we do not have access to the area. So the only international organization that does have limited access is the International Committee of the Red Cross, who are allowed to evacuate the most severe wounded to the hospitals. And we are then in the hospital in Vavunia and Point Pedro with surgical teams where we operate on those people and look after them.
And what sort of stories do you hear from these patients? I mean, are many of these people genuinely civilians or are some of them actually fighters for the Tamil Tigers?
This is very difficult for me to determine, but as far as I'm concerned, as soon as somebody is wounded, they are civilian and we give them the medical care. We hear terrible stories from all sorts of people. So the age range that we see very small wounded children and we see very old wounded people and anything in between, both male and female. So all age groups are represented. And we hear terrible stories about how people spend days and days on end in bunkers with continuous shelling going on. how people do not have enough food, not enough clean drinking water, there is no sanitation, and there is no medicine. And on top of that, the monsoon season has just started, so there's a lot of flooding as well. And you put all that together with the continuous shelling, it's really, really a very desperate situation.
I mean, you said at the beginning that you don't actually have access to the beach area where these people are trapped, but I don't know whether the Tamil Tigers still have artillery, but can one assume that anybody who was wounded by an artillery shell, and obviously doctors can tell that it was artillery and not just a bullet, can one assume that these people were wounded by artillery from the government?
Actually, it's very difficult to say, because as far as I know, both parties are shelling. To me, it's also not very interesting. What we see are terrible wounds and people in pain and having terrible stories, and how they got wounded or by which side, we don't know. So it's very difficult for us to say.
MSF's Anne-Marie Loof talking to Jonathan Steele. Well, in Britain, a group of MPs deliver a letter to Downing Street today calling for the situation in Sri Lanka to be debated by the UN Security Council. Hundreds of Tamil protesters have been demonstrating in London outside Parliament, urging Britain to do more to secure a ceasefire. On Monday, up to 5,000 demonstrators had gathered at the Houses of Parliament. By yesterday morning, numbers had dwindled to around 900. Lifeboats were standing by in case demonstrators carried out their threat to hurl themselves into the Thames, as one man did on Monday evening. He wasn't seriously hurt. But here's what some of the protesters have been saying.
We were demanding a permanent ceasefire in Sri Lanka. Over 350,000 people are trapped, and the Sri Lankan government is trying to annihilate all of us. All the Tamils in there. It's like a Rwanda. It's a genocide that's going on there.
What's your name?
Inthu Rivaraja.
Why are you here?
I'm here with the rest of the Tamil citizens in Britain because we're protesting against what's happening in Sri Lanka at the moment. We sat down peacefully. We are protesting peacefully.
My name is Vernon.
And why are you here?
We're just doing a protest for our own country, Sri Lanka, yeah? There's a war between the Tamils and the Sinhalese, yeah? And then they're just killing, like, so many civilians, yeah? They're, like, even yesterday we was doing a protest here. 1,200 people died in the gas bombing yesterday, yeah? Not just that. Today, like, after, like, all this happened, yeah, the police just start charging us, yeah? Like, they're just fucking... They just start throwing people. You know, we've got the
chemical rights,
yeah?
We
ask the parliament, yeah, and then we come here for a protest, yeah? We're not doing anything illegally, yeah? But then the police, yeah, they don't understand why we're here, yeah? Like, we're just trying to fucking make them understand, but I don't think they understand.
Matt Weaver reporting. In the Abruzzo region of central Italy, efforts are continuing today to search for survivors after Monday's earthquake. As John Hooper reports from L'Aquila, the extent of the devastation is now becoming clear.
The death toll, despite expectations for the contrary, has risen above 200, and we now know that more than 1,000 people were injured, 100 of them seriously. 17,000 people are without homes, and the government is doing what it can to give them at least temporary shelter.
What will become of those 17,000 people in need of shelter?
Well, the government will initially put them into tent cities that are being set up, 20 of them. Some others are being put into hotels. Others, of course, can go to stay with relatives. And there are probably many more who are not in the position of actually being homeless, but who are just frightened to go back into their homes. There have been estimates right up to 70,000 of the number of people who are effectively, if not technically, without a place to go.
Meanwhile, John, rescue efforts are continuing. I mean, what are the hopes now of pulling further survivors from the rubble?
Well, I'm at the moment outside the students' residence in L'Aquila, where they're beginning a very delicate operation to try to demolish slowly over a period of time this quite high four-story structure to try to make it lighter and therefore get at the people, the four students
whom they know are inside. What they don't know is whether they're dead or alive.
John, what are you able to tell us about the extent of the damage to historic buildings? Because this was a medieval city, wasn't it?
Yes, there has been damage to a number of buildings, not only in the city but outside, that are of heritage value. There are churches which have been split right down the centre. There are facades that have fallen away. But this is being, at the moment, a bit put on the back burner by the government because, in fact, Silvio Berlusconi, when he held a press conference here earlier today, said that he had spoken to his heritage and arts minister and asked him to stay away because he said the priority at the moment is to try to find survivors and deal with those who are without homes. But, however, an inventory is to be carried out, a detailed assessment, and a reckoning made of just how much restoration can be done because this is an area in which Italy has enormous expertise and where it may well be able to put right some of the damage that has been done.
John Hooper. The amount of litter on Britain's beaches has more than doubled in the last 15 years. It's now at a record level, according to the latest annual survey by the Marine Conservation Society. The charity's 2008 survey of UK shores found 385,000 items of rubbish, including fishing nets, plastic bags, cigarette butts and cotton bud sticks. Sue Kinsey is the Society's Pollution Control Manager.
Unfortunately, we found that the greatest increase in litter on our beaches since 1994, so it's 110% increase in the amount of litter since we started surveying in 1994. On the good side of things, we had more volunteers than ever, so over 5,000 volunteers actually took part in our surveys around the UK.
How do you account for the doubling in the amount of litter found on Britain's beaches in the last 15 years?
A lot of the problem is now so many items are made of plastic, and as useful as plastic is, in the marine environment it's incredibly long-lasting, estimates of hundreds to thousands of years. And it doesn't really ever sort of biodegrade, it just breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces and plastic dust, which are themselves then being ingested by animals and possibly working their way up the food chain.
And what kind of items are we talking about?
We're talking about everything you could possibly think of that might end up in the sea, from a small bottle to huge amounts of fishing nets with plastic bags and everything in between.
How much of the waste was industrial, left by shipping?
At the moment, we source about 2% of the litter to shipping. We think we possibly may be underestimating that because obviously shipping is quite a difficult one to source very categorically. We try and source as much as precisely as we can. So some items that are at the moment in our non-source category may be coming from shipping, but they could equally be coming from shipping, fishing or public, which is why we don't put them in a category at the moment.
And which areas of the UK coastline are particularly bad for litter?
The southwest suffers particularly because it's just a sort of quirk of tides and currents, and it's near some very busy shipping lanes. And so a lot of the litter from the channel gets swept up onto the southwest beaches. It's not that the people in the southwest are particularly dirty and throw lots of rubbish. Their problem is a lot of litter coming in from the sea.
Do we have any idea, Sue, how much is spent each year on cleaning up litter on the beach?
Well, there have been various studies trying to estimate this, but we know it runs into the millions of pounds by local councils every year just trying to clean up our beaches. And obviously, ultimately, that's down to the taxpayer. And we think that's millions of pounds that could be spent on doing much better things.
What more would you like the government to do to clean up the beaches?
What we're asking the government to do is, at the moment, there's no real coherent strategy for dealing with marine litter. There are sort of pockets of work going on, but nothing coordinated. What we're asking the government to do is actually formulate a proper marine litter strategy and appoint some specific bodies to carry out those tasks. The problem is marine litter comes from so many different sources. that we can't, as a small charity, we can't tackle that. We can just point out the problem and show that it's growing. What it needs is concerted action from above to actually sort of solve this problem.
Sue Kinsey from the Marine Conservation Society. Phil Maynard and Doug Hardy produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.